I'm Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine.
As Prelude, were you one of those people living in New York that somehow got a chance to listen to the Get Back release, you know, the early release of this music that most of us came to know as Let It Be?
I heard some versions of some songs on the radio. I mean, I distinctly remember hearing a version of Let It Be with a much tougher guitar solo, for example. But beyond that, I mean, I think I pretty much heard the same version, you know, that everyone else did when they heard it. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the chronology was, but I remember being surprised at the sound of the Let It Be album when I got the Let It Be album, because the version of the title track that I had been hearing was different, and you know, it was from the Glyn Johns sessions, I'm sure.
Right. And some stations in New York were playing it?
Yeah, it seemed like that's what was on the radio, you know, and it was a different sort of thing. And initially, I preferred the earlier version, you know, to the one that was on the album, to the Phil Spector-produced one. You know, eventually I came to like, actually, the Spector versions a lot, which I realize is a somewhat controversial position. But, I mean, for example, I mean, the whole, hoopla over the Long and Winding Road. I mean, I think it's a far better song in Phil Spector's hands than in the version on Let It Be Naked, for example.
And why?
I think Spector turned it into a song. I mean, it's kind of a sketch in McCartney's version. It's nice, but it's like listening to a demo. You know, I think if you're hiring Phil Spector to go in there and work on your record, you know, he's going to do some things. And that the grandeur of the string arrangements that he put on The Long and Winding Road, it seems to me suits the theme of that song. It's kind of an elegy for the Beatles. It's an elegy for the 60s. And I think Spector understood that. You know, I never really put a lot of credence in McCartney's objections to it. You know, I think, you know, there are people who see that string arrangement as, you know, gloppy and sentimental. It's like, well, you know, I think, you know, Spector was working a lot inside McCartney's frame for things like that. You know, I mean, this is the guy who wrote silly love songs. So I don't think that what Spector did was really out of character for that, what that song could become, for what McCartney might himself have done with it, and for what the song meant at the time. I felt he did a great job.
Was Spector kind of a convenient scapegoat for material that the Beatles let get out of their hands?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think in retrospect, you know, the Beatles objected, or some of the Beatles, or McCartney, essentially. you have to remember that after Let It Be, you know, Spector produced records with George Harrison and with John Lennon, and was still very much involved in their world. You know, he was a part of the Alan Klein camp, which was removed, you know, from McCartney. And I think that all got tied in with, you know, McCartney's ultimate feelings about what the song became. But, you know, look, those tapes were there for the Beatles to work on if they wanted to work on them. They were there for, you know, other people to do whatever they wanted with. You know, they picked Phil Spector. And again, picking Phil Spector is not like just picking, you know, a talented producer who would come in and do something. You're picking an auteur. You know, he's going to put his stamp on it. And I felt that the stamp that he put on it was appropriate to what that material was, you know. You know, but I think in McCartney's mind afterwards, my understanding is that McCartney had to approve, that all four Beatles had to approve this project for it to come out. So at some point or another, you know, McCartney approved it. And I also recall that The Long and Winding Road won some awards, and McCartney was there to accept those awards, you know. And I think, you know, as time went on, you know, and as I think a lot of the, I mean, time didn't heal in this particular case. I think you know, every time McCartney thought about that album, he imagined that he had another vision for it at the time. But the fact is, he didn't have another vision for it at the time. None of them did. And Spector did. He got called in to do a job, and he did a job. And he did a good job.
So my listeners will be hearing this work roll out sort of chronologically, and we'll be hearing, you know, some outtakes from their 69 sessions, basically the month of January. And what I'm looking for from some of my commentators are just some ideas about, you know, there's this sort of script narrative about that this was the breakdown point for the Beatles. And as, you know, I know you know, and like Michael's article points out too, that there's, you know, a lot of layers to this. So what do you think are just some important things to remember about the Beatles' evolution as people and as a band by the time they're working on this material in early 1969? And in terms of helping people understand, you know, what's happening and what they didn't know was going on back in the day.
Well, I don't think anybody really understood how fractured the Beatles were, you know, in the beginning of 1969. I'm sure the people around them understood that. And, you know, you could make some sense out of it, you know, listening to the White Album. But a lot of that was speculation, and most of it is hindsight, as a matter of fact. I mean, the Beatles had a kind of stature that, God, I mean, to talk about the Beatles at that point was sort of to talk about the air or the sun. I mean, they were, you know, that central to everybody's consciousness. You know, that said, you know, the Beatles had come to be seen as a little soft and a little remote. You know, early 1969, there was a feeling, certainly politically, things were shaking very hard in the United States. There was a, you know, this term that gets tossed around all the time, revolution, you know, didn't seem that ridiculous at the moment. You know, there was, the country had become radicalized to a certain degree and polarized to an extent that we wouldn't see again until very recently. So within that, the Beatles came to seem almost, you know, the kind of good news band. You know, I mean, like you had, you know, the some of the bands in San Francisco, you know, certainly the Jefferson Airplane. You had, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know, kind of emerging and presenting a much kind of rawer vision of what was going on. And so you could never question the Beatles' importance at that point. I mean, they were, you know, would be like, I don't know, you know, my family was Italian Catholic. You know, it would be like Italian Catholic. You know, you do what you want. You know, you kind of live your life the way you want, but you would never question the Pope. You know, the Beatles were a little bit like that. You know, even if you didn't necessarily live your life according to the idea that the Beatles were the most important thing around, their importance was absolutely unquestioned. And, you know, even if in your day-to-day life you were really listening to the Rolling Stones, or, you know, had a view of the world that was a little bit harder than what the Beatles were putting forward, there no one would ever say, oh, the Beatles are irrelevant, even though they seemed a little bit removed. I mean, that is my recollection of that period.
And then when you think about the music that they're producing in January, acknowledging too that a lot of the stuff that wound up on Abbey Road got started in January. But let's just talk about the tracks that are on Let It Be. There's a lot of mixed opinion about it. I mean, I've talked with a lot of people already, and some just say, you know, well, I won't put thoughts in your mind, but it runs the gamut, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, as a listening experience, again, when the album came out, even in the context of whether we thought the Beatles were about done or not, how does it stand up as a listening experience to you? First, generally, and then, you know, we can talk about specific tracks.
Do you mean, are you referring to Let It Be now?
Yeah.
Yeah. I always enjoyed Let It Be. I enjoyed it when it came out, and I was very gripped by the movie. And while I don't often play it, I do enjoy listening to it now. It's what I mostly feel about it is a sense of nostalgia. You know, there's an element of you know what the Beatles were, and at moments they really do get back and they do recapture, you know, some of that energy of the early days. And if you listen to something like, you know, the one after 909, you know, there's, you know, it just sounds like they're having fun and they're joking around with each other. That element is what I find moving, along with, you know, coupled with, you know, the obvious signs of their dissolution and tension. You know, I think that, you know, in some sense, those ballads that are on that record are all kind of, you know, requiem for the Beatles and requiem for that period. You know, it's so it's a more emotionally compelling experience, I think, than people give it credit for. You know, is it one of the great Beatles albums? No. You know, I don't think it, you know, it stands up next to, well, next to Abbey Road, for example, or, you know, next to some of the great, you know, early stuff, or certainly next to Rubber Soul and Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's. But, you know, there's really good stuff on it, and it's a record that it seems to me is kind of essential to an understanding of the Beatles.
Well, you talked about Long and Winding Road, mentioned One After 909. Maybe pick a couple of other just tracks and that would represent something that you sort of look forward to when that album comes around, and tell me why, starting with the name of whatever track you would like to.
Let me see. Hang on.
Do you need a track reminder list?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
Well, a track that I really enjoy is I've Got a Feeling. You know, you get a sense of the connection between Lennon and McCartney on the record, even though in a sense they're also kind of singing two different songs. There's a kind of casualness to the presentation that you really have a sense of a band at work and these two mighty talents at work, and at work in a way that, you know, really the sum is greater than each of its individual parts, which in many ways would prove to be true throughout their solo careers. So, you know, I've Got a Feeling just has that. There's a kind of sweetness, you know, when Lennon sings that part, you know, when he comes in with his part about, you know, everybody does this and everybody does that, you know, there's that, it's a very kind of a 60s sentiment, you know, as different as your life might be from that of the Beatles, you know, you share in these qualities with them. There's a sweetness there that you didn't often hear, you know, at that time as the 60s were getting a little bit harsher. I think, you know, if you listen to Get Back, you really get a sense of, you know, maybe what McCartney was wanting to do in the first place. You know, this idea of the Beatles kind of toughening up a little bit and maybe doing some live shows and, you know, not doing such elaborate work in the studio. You know, there's a sense on the song of a tremendous ease. You know, and they're just rocking. You know, it's a nice sense of the Beatles again as a band. You know, often in their manifestations, there was a kind of sense of the you know, kind of the Beatles, you know, issuing statements from Mount Olympus or something, or you know, from some undisclosed location. You know, Get Back sounded like a band working, and Billy Preston in that terrific organ solo that he takes, you know, just really lends that feel. It was nice for them to kind of open the door a little bit and, you know, let somebody else in to, you know, to participate and to bring something that freshened up their sound a bit. You know, so it was, you kind of get a sense again listening to Get Back of what Get Back, the project, if it had been realized, might have been, and it might have been pretty great.
Can you recall, and then also maybe provide the long view of the experience of watching the rooftop concert at the end of that film. I mean, when you were saying issuing from Mount Olympus and in remote places, you know, that almost described what the rooftop concert was. It was high above everything, but you couldn't quite see them. But, you know, maybe to talk a little bit about what that experience was like for you to watch that on film and think about it later.
By 1969 or 1970, you know, when you were watching the movie Let It Be and you watched, you know, that concert sequence at the end, by that point you'd almost forgotten that the Beatles were a band that used to go out and play shows. You know, there was a sense in which so much had happened. You know, when the Beatles went off the road in 1966, you know, Dylan went off the road right around then. The Rolling Stones went off the road right around then. You know, rock and roll went through this transformation where it became rock and audiences were expected to kind of sit and listen. And then, of course, there was the San Francisco kind of more ecstatic, you know, concert experience. And the Beatles missed all that. You know, so then suddenly they're standing on a rooftop playing like a band. I mean, it was... it's a very interesting thing. I mean, there were a million reasons for it, but the fact that it was so hard for them to try to just even figure out a place to play, you know, they were, you know, until finally somebody said, well, look, let's just do it on the roof, you know, of Apple, you know, the very fact that they were having so much of a hard time, you know, was an indication of what was going on with them and how everything had become difficult. Everything had become complicated. But in fact, when they were playing, again, there was a kind of ease to it. You know, they were enjoying themselves. At least it looks like they were enjoying themselves. And, you know, they sounded great. And, you know, you wish you'd gotten some more of it. I mean, that was, you know, that was the feeling I got. I'd like to mention, I mean, I remember one time when I was working on staff at Rolling Stone, and I was, you know, I was at the office every day, and I was leaving one day, and Jan Wenner and I were, you know, walking down Fifth Avenue. We were going to a movie screening together, and we, for some reason, we started talking about the Beatles, and, you know, I asked him about Let It Be. That came up, and he goes, "Well, you know, I saw that with John and Yoko. John and Yoko had come to San Francisco and visited the Rolling Stone offices, and John and Jan and Yoko and Jane Wenner, Jan's then wife, went to see Let It Be, which was showing there. And Jan said it was a very moving experience, and that John and Yoko were crying, you know, after it, and that, you know, they were saddened by it, and he was saddened by it, you know, and ultimately the movie is, you know, is affecting in that way. But you know, to have that firsthand experience that Jan did of seeing Lennon, who is often, you know, seen as obviously, you know, just kind of tough and arrogant, and, you know, the guy wanted to break up the Beatles first, you know, was deeply affected by what that movie showed, because, you know, it did show, you know, a band in the process of dissolution.
Yeah. Briefly, what else was going on, since this will be kind of a chronological march through that year, what else was going on with the Beatles between, say, like February and August that you actually recall experiencing as a fan following in the news of the time, and or something that you think's important to kind of look at in terms of their story from, you know, sort of in between the recording times?
Well, the main recollection I have of 1969 and the Beatles and pretty much everything else that was happening was just how fast everything seemed to be moving. Things were really accelerating, and it was very difficult to make sense out of everything as it was happening, because something equally important and strange seemed to happen right after it. You know, but within all this, there were, you know, arrests of members of the Beatles. You know, there were marriages, you know, Paul got married and John got married, and then suddenly, you know, there was this kind of sense that everything was changing. You know, John was releasing singles on his own and you know, playing on his own. There was a kind of sense that it was very difficult to make sense of what all that meant, because it was a time when, you know, this idea of the supergroup, of bands breaking up and reconfiguring, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, being the kind of great classic example of this. But, you know, there were many, many other examples. There was an album called Super Session with, you know, Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield, and, you know, various, this sense that there was another big set of changes going on. There was also this sense, you know, it was almost like the end of a millennium, you know, the way that the late 90s kind of were odd because of a millennial thinking. The end of the 60s were a little bit like that. You know, there was a sense that, you know, 1969, you know, obviously the number 69 has, you know, obviously sexual connotations, but it also, you know, 6 and 9 are kind of mystical numbers. And there was a sense in which this decade, you know, that by that point had firmly established itself as the 60s, was coming to a close. There was a sense of, you know, were things going to be realized or were things going to fall apart? There was, by 69, there was certainly a sense that, you know, we might not really make this work. You know, the whatever the Summer of Love and all of these earlier kind of utopian notions that informed the 60s. By 69, there was an element of, you know, that none of that might really happen. You know, it started to get a little scary, to be honest. So that was a bit of a backdrop. So all of this fragmentation around the Beatles very well kind of suited that tenor of the times. You know, there was a sense that, you know, things were breaking, you know, and things were shaking. And that was 1969.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then before the end of the year, I guess I actually recorded some in April and finished in July, I would guess. Abbey Road is placed in the picture. Can you recall the, let's see, you were what, 17, 18?
I was 18.
18, yeah. Right. So the 18-year-old Anthony DeCurtis experiencing Abbey Road in the fall of 69, what's that like?
Well, when Abbey Road came out in late 69, I was 18 years old, and there was a sense in which, you know, this was a Beatles record and had all the import of a Beatles album coming, you know, right here at the end of the decade. And I do remember that, you know, there was this element of finality to it, you know, this sense of, you know, with the second side, you know, that whirl of songs that, you know, kind of got strung together into, you know, something like an opera. That was a very current notion, by the way, at the time. You know, Tommy was in the air. And so that idea that all of these pieces had come together, you know, it seemed like some kind of grand statement, you know, which ended with this, you know, with these now famous lines, you know, in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. It was powerful, you know. There was a sense in which, you know, you still had to get up the next day and go to school and do the things that you do. But there was certainly a feeling that something might have passed, you know. Specifically about that lyric, about the love you take is equal to the love you make. There was a great, when Chris Farley was on Saturday Night Live, and he used to play like an interviewer, you know, a very, very kind of desperately earnest interviewer. And Paul McCartney was on the show. And, you know, there was all this, so you were in the Beatles? That's awesome kind of stuff, which was very funny. But at the end, Chris Farley looks at McCartney and just says, he goes, you know, you wrote, you know, the love you take, you know, is equal to the love you make. Is that true? And that's a great question. You know, that really is a great question. I mean, I think, you know, it was a characteristic McCartney line, you know, and it's just a question that I might want to ask. I mean, I've interviewed McCartney. I've never had occasion to really to really ask him that bluntly about it. But, you know, I think that there was a sense that McCartney did want to say something like that. You know, like, that's what this came down to. We got what we put into it. You know, we got the best. When we gave our best, we got the best back. And when we failed, we got back less than love. We got back failure. So, you know, there was something that was very rich about that record. I'd like to talk about, you know, people, I mean, a lot of people complain about the second side of Abbey Road. You know, it's strung together. These are obviously all fragments. Well, hello. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just people's naivete about how songs get written. But very, very often, you know, you have part of one song that you're working on another song, particularly if writers are working together. And somebody comes up with something and suddenly that little verse that you wrote, you know, for some song you were working on or some song maybe you forgot about, you know, turns up somewhere else. You know, four fragments, there's plenty of good stuff in there and plenty of stuff that, again, suited that moment. You know, you never give me your money. I mean, all of the fighting that the Beatles were doing, you know, carry that weight. You know, this sense of a grand statement about what the history of that band was. I think really that second side of Abbey Road amounts to that. It's like a fast forward through the history of the Beatles with that lovely ending. It's I personally just don't understand the dismissals of it. You know, by people who evidently think that any band, you know, just has, you know, sort of pieces of songs lying around that are that good and that could that easily lend themselves to a longer, more holistic treatment. I can assure you there aren't. And, you know, it's to this day, it's a very powerful listen.
Well, it's fun because each one of the fragments also has one or two really remarkable musical performances or instrumental moments that sustain them for me, you know, to hear, you know, just take your pick of like the drum fills in Mean Mr. Mustard or the propulsion of Polythene Pam or just, you know. There are moments in there where they shine as musicians. I don't know if you can expand on that a little bit.
There were these very powerful musical moments in that suite on the second side of Abbey Road. I mean, for example, in the end where, you know, there are three guitar solos, you know, one by, you know, Lennon takes one, Harrison takes one, McCartney takes one. You know, the Beatles weren't big on this kind of guitar dueling thing, you know, and just hearing them play that way and flex that way as musicians in a band was exciting. You know, there was the singing also, you know, is, you know, McCartney sings in about three or four different voices. You know, the voice he uses on, She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, you know, is a very different voice from the one he's using, when he sings something like, when they get to that part of, you know, well, in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. I mean, he's singing there in his kind of choir boy voice. You know, there's a sense of the Beatles just showing all of it. You know, that's, I think, what, you know, these songs demonstrate is this range of this band's power and their kind of offhand way of just demonstrating their quite extraordinary skill, you know, as singers, as players, as writers. Yeah, you know, it's pretty awe-inspiring.
Well, there's something different, I think, about the way people were experiencing the Beatles because of the way in which they were in some ways marketed from the beginning. But there was this sense of, you know, recognizing, oh, that's Paul and that's John and that's Ringo and that's George. You know, there's like all four of them have a presence on the sequence of an album. And, you know, when they pop up, by that time anyway, less so in the beginning maybe, but by that time I remember, you know, being able to look forward to and distinguish their appearances, you know. And so in a way, it was sort of like four characters in a vaudeville show or something. You know, they each come out from behind the curtain and they're there in the front for a while and they do their bit and then somebody else strolls out.
Well, the thing about the Beatles, you know, even at this point of dissolution, you know, you have a recollection of, you know, this idea of, you know, in a way that really wasn't particularly true of other bands, you know, this question that kids still talk about today, which is, who's your favorite Beatle? You know, that, you know, sense of, you know, you had the smart one and the cute one and, you know, on and on. That element of their individuality coming together for something greater was very much a part of what the Beatles represented finally. And it was, you know, a kind of 60s value, a communal value. As that started to break down, you know, it's in the culture, it broke down in the band, you know, and that's why it's poignant to hear those records now, you know, because that's part of it. You know, you could stand in awe of the individual talent, but, you know, your sense is that what has been lost is this greater thing.
Would you be willing to make, because I was striving to think of it when you were making that point about McCartney's display of vocal athleticism. The song that really he does that is You Never Give Me Your Money, because, you know, it starts with that very sweet, kind of soft, and then he does this old rockin' thing where he's going, you know, Monday morning, turning back.
Sure.
And then he slips back into the One Sweet Dream, then he's doing that. If you could implant that point into that song, that would be possibly helpful for me later.
I'll go back over it. You know, one of the things that comes up in that suite on the second side of Abbey Road is, you know, this incredible kind of prowess of the Beatles. And, you know, I mean, McCartney, for example, if you take a track like You Never Give Me Your Money, you know, he's singing in, you know, like three different voices, you know, on that. You know, like it's, you know, when you hear him at the beginning, you know, there's the kind of sweet McCartney, you know, and it's longing. And then there's, you know, when the song picks up and he's singing in this kind of rock and roll voice. And then by the end of it, you know, he's kind of almost in his Little Richard mode. You know, there's an element of what he can do as a singer to suit the moment, to suit the song, just kind of tossing it off. I think, you know, people had come to just kind of take that level of talent and skill and versatility, you know, for granted. But, you know, when you hear it now, after all this time even, you just kind of go, wow. Yeah. You know, that's pretty good.
It's really such a, that song, I'm just thinking about it, such an amazing song. Okay, I want to be sensitive to John's time and yours too. We're about a half an hour talking here, but are there other notions about Abbey Road tracks or history?
I want to look at a track list before we stop.
Okay. Yeah. I know you want to give Ringo his props for Octopus's Garden, so I want to leave time for that. So.
Hang on a second. My daughter likes that song. She's
I made a disc for my nephews and nieces when they were younger that, you know, Beatles for kids, and there's easily 12, 13 songs throughout their time together that really play well that way.
Well, you know, what's one of the interesting things about Abbey Road is, you know, one of my favorite tracks on it is Come Together, you know, the first track. You know, it's John Lennon's song he wrote for a political campaign that Tim Leary was doing, but it, you know, it lent itself nicely to Lennon's own kind of messianic fantasies. But it really felt, I mean, the lyrics are so, there's a kind of wonderful, genial surrealism to the lyrics of that song. But at the same time, there's a sense in which it's a song about a moment that had passed. This come-together moment seemed past even at that point. And so it was almost, it caught a sense of that feeling that was around a little bit at the moment. Is, you know, are the Beatles attuned to just how fractious things have gotten? And so to hear Lennon sing Come Together, you know, it was like, this is a great song. I mean, I really like it. The lyrics are hilarious. You know, it's a great performance. But, you know, if you take this idea of Come Together seriously, it was kind of like an idea that, you know, almost was impossible anymore. And in that sense, it's a very contemporary sounding song. I mean, it's like if you made that statement now, you know, in a time of tremendous polarization as there was then, you know, it's like, well, I don't know if I want to come together, you know, it's, you know, and the other side doesn't really want to either. So it's a song without, you know, in a sense, without, that's striving for a larger meaning, but I don't think anybody was really there to hear it. Though as a song, it's a terrific song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that made any sense whatsoever.
Well, no, it's an interesting. I've talked with some others about it. There's lots of interesting things about that, of course, several commentators have made a point about Harrison's contributions here. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that.
Yeah. There was this sense. I mean, one element in the Beatles' breakup that often gets overlooked was, you know, just how overlooked Harrison was. You know, there was, you know, this element of, you know, when Lennon and McCartney really couldn't agree on just about anything, they both agreed that their songs were more important than George Harrison's. And, you know, by the time you get to Abbey Road and you're getting songs like Something and you're getting Here Comes the Sun, you're really getting the sense of Harrison completely coming into his own. You know, these are, you know, beautiful, delicate, and very emotion-filled tracks. You know, very different. You know, Harrison's stuff before that often seemed, you know, like Within You, Without You, when the Beatles put a laugh track at the end of Sgt. Pepper to just say, look, we're not quite this serious. You know, Harrison seemed to be kind of opening up his heart a little bit more in his songwriting. And of course, you know, those are two of his greatest songs.
Do you have a recollection in that year of being swept into the Paul is Dead stuff?
Oh yeah. I thought that was 1968. That was at 69.
69. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Cause it really,
oh, right. Of course, because of the Abbey Road cover and stuff. Yeah.
Well, if
and
if
let you, me, yeah, let me, I, yeah, if, was there, unless there's something specific about it, you want me to,
no, I know, I'm just also, I'm going to include it, you know, sort of parenthetically among the things that happened in 69, and if you can, you know, tell a little reflection about hearing that for the first time and where it took you, or.
Well, the Paul is Dead rumors that began in 69 really were, I mean, in retrospect, you can see it was like the first version of, you know, that, you know, I saw Elvis down at the 7-Eleven, or, you know, Tupac didn't really die, or, you know, they took Jim Morrison and he's somewhere else. He went to Tangiers, like, like a French symbolist poet, you know, he didn't die. You know, this kind of refusal to believe, you know, what essentially is right in front of your eyes, which is, you know, that sensibility, which I have to say is sort of a paranoid sensibility that was very much, I think, part of the time. You know, on its gentler aspect, I mean, I think that there was a sense of, you know, things were falling apart, and it was another echo of the Kennedy assassination to me. because there were all of those rumors about John Kennedy as well. And, you know, the Beatles, of course, came on the scene in America right on the heels of the Kennedy assassination. And in many ways, you know, those emotions tracked their own progress. I mean, here were these, you know, young figures from Camelot, you know, with longish hair, who spoke well, who were witty. And then suddenly the same elements of attempting to grapple with their loss or departure or fracturing, you know, generated that, you know, that same kind of myth making, really. You know, it,
I'm confused.
It was odd business.
Let me interrupt because I'm confused about the point. Everything you compare it to is more about somebody who died, who the myths try to keep alive, and McCartney's was just the opposite.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a sense of, you know, two sides of the same coin. You know, I mean, I think that whatever the form took of these various myths, you know, whether you're trying to keep John Kennedy alive or, you know, discover the fact that Paul McCartney is really dead, what you're trying to come to grips with is the departure of something. And this sense of the Beatles, you know, just beginning to fracture and, you know, possibly disappear was, I think, you know, something that was in the air. As was, you know, all of the you know, the end of the 60s and all of those sense of endings. And the idea that somehow this was all encoded, it was all written in, almost in a kind of way of a prophecy, you know. I mean, the other aspect is it's a kind of derangement, a deranged version of how people used to look at Beatles records anyway, or Dylan records. You know, where you would pore over the lyrics and the photos and everything about them to discover their hidden messages. You know, it's not too much of a step from that to say, to get to something like Paul is dead. They're trying to conceal something from us, you know, that we have to discover in these clues that they're giving us. You know, it was very, very odd. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember believing it at the time?
You know, it was one of those things. I mean, look, I didn't believe it, but I, you know, I traced the clues. You know, I mean, look, I didn't believe that, you know, Dark Side of the Moon was made along with, you know, the Wizard of Oz either. But, you know, I sat around and smoked pot with a bunch of friends and watched one and listened to the other. I mean, you never know.
Just last week?
What's that?
Just last week?
No, not last week. But whatever it was, you know, whatever that, when that rumor was happening 4 or 5 years ago. You know, there was a sense of, you know, I mean, partly I was interested in it. You know, I was intrigued by it. And then, you know, again, so much was going on at the time. You thought, well, God, could this possibly be true? But, you know, if somebody, you know, if push came to shove and somebody said, well, do you believe it? I would have said, no, I don't believe it.
Well, I want to wrap up and but also just give you a chance to put a period on this because obviously at the end of this program there will be some reflection on just the moment of ending for this group, and maybe that came to you in 1970. Maybe you've thought about it in more recent times, but how would you characterize the end of this collaboration?
The end of the Beatles to me came with the release of the McCartney album and Paul's kind of self-interview that was included in it, where, you know, he essentially said that he wasn't going to work with the Beatles again and had no plans to. That was the kind of period at the end of the sentence. And so much had happened by that point. I mean, the Beatles breakup at the time was kind of, you know, going out with a whimper and not a bang. I mean, there was a sense, I mean, even if you, you know, get deeper into the history of, you know, Lennon is quitting, and then George quits, but Ringo quits, but he comes back, and Paul then quits. You know, this sense of, you know, obviously they were ambivalent about what they were doing. But that was also reflected. There was a sense in which, you know, something was going on. And, you know, it was not shocking to hear that the Beatles were breaking up. But its true meaning and its true impact didn't become apparent until later, you know. When, within a few years, there were very, very active efforts to try to get them to come back together again. And, you know, it was like an origins myth, you know, can we get back to Eden? Can we reconstruct that? And, you know, of course, that never really happened.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, in a sense, the Beatles were well served by the arc of their career, because it's very comprehensible to people. You know, you don't have to be some Beatles expert to really get a lot of what the Beatles did, because there's a coherent body of work that, you know, doesn't span decades. It spans a comprehensible period of time. It has very discernible periods within it. And all you have to do is be interested and listen to the stuff, and you can grapple with it, you know. And in a sense, I think that's one of the, apart from the great quality of what the Beatles did, the kind of elegance of the arc of their career is something that has held them in good stead. And, you know, if they'd done 40 reunion tours, you know, it might not really have served them nearly as well.